Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Far Science Show. Today, we're having an experimental episode. So far in the podcast, you've heard interviews with experts from all around the world on subjects that they are researching. You've heard me speaking on things that I believe had some experience. And today, what we have is a topic that none of the people involved in the discussion are experts at, because that's actually fire safety of Mars habitats. I'm not sure if anyone is an expert on that. And we gave us liberty to just talk about the topic. We called it the brainstorm session, because that's literally what we are doing here, brainstorming some ideas. And it's just a nice conversation between people who love fire safety and are thrown on a very abstract subject of providing fire safety to a Mars habitat. I have two experts with me, Professor Ruben van Coyle from Ghent University and Jaime Cadena Gomez from Transurban. Both were on the podcast already. And I have a friend who started this discussion, Shemek Matkowski, an architect who is involved in Nexus Aurora community, whose hobby is, or passion is, to design Mars habitats. So please join us in this conversation. That's what it is. It's a conversation where we all, as the discussion goes, try to figure out what the safety on a Mars habitat could look like. Of course, disclaimer, don't build a Mars habitat to our specification. This requires research and an expertise. Well, let's spin the intro, and I hope you enjoy this discussion. Welcome to the Fire Science Show. My name is Wojciech Wingrzyński, and I will be your host. This episode of the Fire Science Show and the whole podcast in this year is brought to you in partnership with OFR Consultants, a multi-award-winning independent consultancy dedicated to addressing fire safety challenges. OFR is the UK's leading fire risk consultancy. Its globally established team has developed a reputation for preeminent fire engineering expertise, with colleagues working across the world to help protect people, property and environment. In UK, that includes redevelopment of Printworks building in Canada Water, one of the tallest residential buildings in Birmingham, as well as historic structures like the National Gallery, National History Museum and the National Portrait Gallery in London. Internationally, its work ranges from Antarctic to the Atacama Desert in Chile and a number of projects across Africa. In 2023, OFR will grow its team, and it's keen to hear from industry professionals who want to collaborate on fire safety futures this year. Get in touch at ofrconsultants.com. And now back to the discussion on Mars habitats. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Fire Science Show. I'm here with three gentlemen. Let me introduce them. First, my dear listener and the person who triggered this discussion, Shemek Matkowski. Hello, Shimon. Great to have you.
Hi, everybody.
Thanks for dropping those questions and starting this interesting conversation. And I also have two experts with me that I've invited, my former guests of the show, who I found very suitable for this podcast episode. First, I have Jaime Cadena Gomez from Transurban, and Jaime's known from his episode on maximum level damage methodology that was published in Fire Science Show and was very well received. Hello, Jaime. Great to have you back in the Fire Science Show.
Thank you, Wojciech. Nice to be here.
Yeah, I'm super happy to have you back. And my second expert is Professor Ruben van Coyle from Ghent University. And Ruben is very well known for risk engineering and all stuff risk related. So there's a lot of risk in this habitat, Ruben. I need you.
Thank you for the invitation.
It's going to be fun. Thanks, guys. So short disclaimers, before it's the first time we're doing a brainstorm session in Fire Science Show. This is not a typical episode. We're not presenting our research in here, and we are giving ourselves liberty to just go wherever our thoughts take us. So please don't take this episode as an outline on how to build a Mars habitat. Anyway, we're brainstorming here. We're coming up with ideas. We are challenging the concepts, and we will see what comes out of that. So first, I would like to give the air to Shmek to very briefly tell to the listeners what the hell is a Mars habitat and how does one more or less look like.
Mars habitat is a place where people can live. This is a place for work, leisure, and sleep and rest. This is a permanent place of stay, which has its psychological effects on the people. This is the pioneering place where you can, when you start to conquer other celestial bodies like Moon or Mars. Hopefully, we will go to Alpha Centauri one day. And this place has a completely different hostile environment around. So you need to protect people in a better way so they can survive and develop colonies. So in the beginning, when we think about conquering the Mars, we are thinking about movie Martian, when you have six people living in the base and everything is wrong or good and they develop the base. But in fact, we are facing in the next, I hope 40, 50 years, we'll be facing many more people on the Mars and on Moon. It's already started and with Artemis. And we will be facing development of such habitats. And I believe it is now time to start discussion about the safety, mostly fire safety, but not only, and how to deal with the problems, how to define fire safety, how to define the safety of the people, what are the principles of the human stay and human safety in such places.
So the boundary conditions, this is permanent. So a person goes there and there is not able to come back until the next shuttle goes back 2 years later, more or less. This is inhabitable outside. So there is no ability to safely exit and run away, in a way, perhaps.
In a way. Yeah. It is, but it's not that common.
Okay. How big the habitats we're talking about? You said six people is a base. So how big is a habitat when it becomes?
So what we are considering in Nexus Aurora as our winning competition in Mars city state is 1 million people. But of course, to go to the 1 million people city, we have a bit more steps to go to. So we are analyzing the bases like 115 people, which are the starting base. When you have a very small society, very survival-oriented society with very close relations and they know each other. And in the future development, goes to the colony. We are thinking a colony is something defined also by my society. It's just like 1,000, 2,000 people. When you have many buildings spread around, but still the community more or less knows each other. Possibly, you have already tourists, which have people with big money that they come 2-3 weeks, no, but a year, for example. And they can pay for getting back. And then we go to jump to the bigger stages and the colony grows up and converts into the city.
Okay. And at this point is growing to a very big size.
And it's far away. It's like 200-300 years, I believe. Maybe less. I hope we will be having currency like Elon.
Fantastic. So the boundaries are more or less set. We know how many people we have. We know what environment we deal with. The biggest change, the biggest difference is perhaps the gravity. But in terms of safety, I got the feeling that it's not going to be the main problem in here looking at the habitat. So, my dear expert friends, we're approached with the concept of defining safety for Martian habitat or fire safety. I've met Shmek at the conference last year and he was presenting evacuation studies and some stuff related to applying human concepts or Earth concepts to designing safety in the space of the Mars habitat. And I wondered, like, should we really apply the Earth concepts like acid acid in there? Maybe it's a nice place to brainstorm something new. Like if we had no preconception of what fire-safe habitat is, let's try and do it from scratch. And that's the topic we're brainstorming right now. So I don't even know where to start. I guess that the whole concept of safety is perhaps a good starting point. So, gentlemen, Ruben?
Well, I can start and say a couple of things, but I'm very curious about some of the boundary conditions there. Right? Because you said, okay, well, there's a concept of safety and so on. I understood so far that the issues there are not just fire related. Basically, if you're talking about single units, possibly any loss of containment would be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still trying to get my head around, are we talking about individual pods where which is divided in different zones, compartments, whatever we want to call them, and outside there is uninhabitable space? Or how should I see that? And how does that then link with other requirements for safety? Can you maybe say something about that?
Of course, when you build outer space, colony base, you base on the modules. You need to build a module because when you grow, you cannot just build anywhere. You need to be connected just because of life support systems. You need to connect because they have to have redundancy. And this is a kind of a natural compartment that you are creating. It's like a submarine, more or less, or in a bigger scale, underwater city. So this is a kind of a earth-based example of how you deal with.
To me, it looks like a metro system, you know.
Yeah, it could be like
perhaps
that.
Perhaps like Metro 2033 style system where you don't have an exit.
Yeah, but yes, and the compartments. They can be naturally formed, but in people enclosed in metro and enclosed in submarine, they flip out. You need to have a bigger spaces. Mm. You need to provide comfortable environment. Otherwise, people just get crazy. Mm.
That's already really interesting. Because you mentioned, for example, submarines. So without knowing much about safety in submarines, the moment you have an issue, somewhere, maybe just in a movie, don't know where I get it from, you can flood a compartment, right? So there is a natural kind of subdivision. If there are issues, might be able to flood a compartment. You say that you want to have a bigger space. Well, then probably your critical systems would not go into those kind of big spaces. The big spaces would be, gathering areas potentially, but not the ones which you want to have with redundancy available all the time. So that's really interesting. I'm curious about what Jaime is going to add to that now.
Jaime, as a tunnel engineer, he's also dealing with spaces where you don't easily get out.
Yeah, well, the whole concept of what it means to design these spaces to be fire safe or fire safe to a certain degree and what degree it is. And I'm talking about fire safety because that's what I think we can talk. But yeah, there's another component which is also related more closely to process safety engineering, which is what Ruben mentioned, loss of containment. So you will have a lot of pressurized cryogenic substances, hazardous substances. You will potentially have water treatment plants of some sort. You will potentially have hazardous waste management of some sort. And that means you will have a lot of hazardous chemicals floating around, no pun intended. You will have a lot of stuff.
I think you also have a lot of recycling, upcycling. This type of processing that in normal like habitat of humans on Earth, you would not do. You would have a special factory somewhere that would do it for you, right? And then here, probably you would be forced to reuse.
Yeah, you will have potentially production of methane out of the garbage that is generated. So you will have hazardous substances that can burn and explode, which is not ideal. And then you will also have just the fact that things burn, upholstery, tools, decorations, architects. I guess that you would know these better than me. There will be things that will be able to burn. And that's what we were discussing just before starting the recording. How much do we want to actually extrapolate from Earth fire safety into these kind of spaces? Because in Earth, we have a lot of layers of protection. Whether it's in a hazardous facility that is processing, let's say, methane, natural gas, or if it's in a building, in a hospital, or in a tunnel, like the ones that I work in right now, we have a lot of layers of protection that deal with fire risk and with other risks, fire, explosion, process risks. Up there, potentially, your layers of protection are going to be much more expensive, and potentially a lot of them will not even be suitable. They might be completely ineffective. So before going into the solution mode of thinking about the tools, the engineering tools that we might use to demonstrate a particular safety level, for me, the conversation is more about what is the acceptance level that we're going to discuss? What is the acceptance, the risk acceptance criteria that would be suitable for such a facility? And we kind of were brainstorming a little bit about that. Is it about compartmentation? Are we willing to sacrifice a particular area? And even if that burns to the ground and completely destroyed, are we happy with that as long as people can evacuate? Or do we want people not even to have to evacuate? We don't even want to compartmentalize. We don't even want to rid any vital system from being compromised. And without having that goalpost, I think it's very hard to go any farther than that. In Earth, we have this implicit acceptance of a certain degree of injuries if there is a fire. Whether we like it or not, and whether it's explicit or not, that's just the reality. People will get injured when they breathe smoke, and that will be potentially many very minor, or it could be really, really bad. But we don't really accept people dying, although they do die in fires, but we don't accept it necessarily. And there's never an explicit recognition of, well, this is how many people we actually accept could potentially die. Now, in this scenario, that would be completely unacceptable. The death of any person, you were giving an interesting example of a very vital person, a medic, someone from maintenance who has very specific knowledge, technical knowledge. You cannot let these people be affected by the fire almost, or by whatever happens, an explosion, a leak.
So, Jaime, let's think about, okay, acceptance. So what kind of damage or consequences of fire would be the threshold that we accept? And how do we come with that on Earth? Like, there's no risk council of humanity that tells us 7 fatalities is too much, right? We came up to some level of acceptance. Ruben, you wanted to jump on that?
In a way, yes, because I have the feeling it is actually not independent of the physics.
Okay.
The entire thing of risk acceptance. It might be tempting to say, oh, first we define what we want to achieve and then we look how it occurs. But to make a very simple example, if you say about falls, people fall all the time, they break their neck, also this can be horrible in the Martian environment. Okay. So you say, we should avoid this. We don't allow people to fall over and break their legs. We will not have any steps, we will not have any stairs and so on. But then the question becomes, okay, but what does this mean in the physics wise? What does it mean to fall in a Mars environment? I'm dropping that there. The other thing is, what does it mean for your structure? As in, if you put everything like single story, massive, what does that mean for how much material you need? What does it mean for everything? It's probably not the most efficient shape you could have for your Martian environment. So while you might want to say, I do not allow anybody to fall over, those 151st people, I don't want stairs, I don't want this, I want that, I don't want that. Your physics might actually constrain you there. And the same thing in a way about the physics, but then sooner or later, and it's the same argument with different perspectives, is the thing about costs really. Also, that is something you cannot just throw out of the window and say, we'll think about that later. And then, because some things, at least at my first impression, some things might be much cheaper to achieve in a Martian environment, wind safety wise, than on Earth, and the opposite as well. So I wouldn't immediately split the two. It's really about an iterative process where you think about, okay, what can we achieve? What does it mean for safety? Is this what we want? Can we do it better? And so on.
So even the acceptance criteria, I mean, applying the concepts from here directly is perhaps not the way. Like, both for preconception of what safety is, for the tools that we're using here and the consequences, fires like happening on Earth and on Mars, will be completely different for sure. And the physics will be different. There will be different physics of smoke flow. There's different gravity. So you will have much slower smoke plumes, much slower smoke movement, which essentially allows you to extract more concentrated smoke, if I may. So it has less entrainment, so it dilutes less, perhaps.
So we talk about different stages of this Martian development, right? So very small, very big ones and so on. So these things will then also different depending on the stage we're thinking of. But I'm just wondering if because of other constraints and other requirements and the physics of it, you might indeed be in a situation where your fire risk acceptance can be extremely strict, I would say, in those early stages. And not just because you say, we don't want any fatalities, because this is always the tricky thing to say. However you put it, then in the end, you say, I want to keep on investing in this single issue while you have many issues to handle. But maybe because of the physics and because of the entire concept there, by doing smart engineering, you might actually indeed be able to have, in effect, a kind of vision zero strategy there.
I wonder about the consequence thing. So here your consequence would span anywhere from like a personal harm and an injury to a person, losing an important part of the infrastructure that decreases the quality of life at the habitat, perhaps, or, you know, brings new challenges, up to losing infrastructure that challenges the survival of the whole colony as a whole thing. Like, your consequences range from small damage up to the complete destruction, death of all inhabitants and inability to recover from that, right?
I would say that there's even, you can even take it a little bit farther back, because if you lose, let's say that you come up with some smart engineering, as Ruben was saying, and you come up with this design that allows you to have a fire, a sizable fire, a big fire that you could have, and then it happens. And then you lose part of the systems that you originally had. So at that point, would you want to keep those people there? Would it be suitable? Would it be safe enough to keep them there? Maybe there won't be any other option because that's where they live. But I think it could also be, well, how reliable do we want those systems to be? Whatever the systems are and whatever they're accomplishing, how reliable do we want them to be over time? And this is, Simon, I don't know, how long is the life expectancy of, let's say, the smallest one, the 115 people? How long do you expect that structure to be operational?
First of all, we need to go with the medical conditions. So you are not able to survive now on Mars long enough, because the travel here and back, it's about 7 plus 7 plus, let's say, 2 months. It's 14 months in outer space, and you already be having problems. The structures, I don't know, it didn't make any proper estimation of how long the structure will last, because this is all about the maintenance and about producing the resources. From in-situ resources, producing the materials. So as soon as you have a kind of industry able to produce spare parts, you can live quite a long.
But sorry, Shimon, but preconception is it's permanent. So I guess.
Yes.
So it's not about single use, 2 years and we come back, but we go there, establish, and perhaps we use it as long as it is technically usable. And we either build a new one with the tools we have on there and grow the colony, or we have to run away and come back.
It's like International Space Station, you know, it was not designed for this. To live that long.
Space exploration has a history of doing that. Voyagers were also not meant to fly that far, and they are. So if I understand you correctly, Jaime, it's not just the initial state of the colony or the initial level of safety, but as the colony uses up its resources, systems, we all know safety systems break down, and it's not that easy to replace them. And also, after the first fire, you will have a new zero, which is much lower than the previous zero, right?
Yeah, which is why I do think the discussion about the acceptance criteria or multiple acceptance criteria, if you want, because there might not be just a single clear-cut criteria, like no one gets injured. That's kind of a idealistic thought rather than a practical view to the problem. And I agree with what Ruben was saying. It cannot be that simple. It could be multiple acceptance criteria. But yeah, and that, what I was talking about, reliability of those systems, becomes much more important over there than in Earth. But if you even look at the systems here on Earth, on the built environment, fire safety is done as a snapshot. You gauge your fire safety or the level of fire safety based on what you're designing today, based on what you're constructing today, what you're certifying today, and then it's kind of set and forget. You have these standards that look after maintenance. You have these standards that look after how technology changes, but you're potentially not going to change much during the lifetime of the building. So it's kind of a set and forget. If it passes the first test at the beginning in the design stage, you're good to go. But the reality is that all these systems degrade with time a lot, and maintenance is not easy on them. And one big issue that a lot of fire safety engineers have, or the profession as such, is that fire safety engineers do not really have exposure to what these systems actually look like. The machines, the circuit board that you have to use, the cabling, the fiber optics that communicate all of these, the proprietary software, which is not made by people who make software, but by people who make electronics, which is a big difference. People are not aware of face proofing, which is a big area in tunneling and could be a major issue in these kind of situations.
What do you mean about space proofing? Like having a minimum space that it takes, or?
Yeah, how much space do you need? Because technology changes with time. And say that you do have a fire and that you do have a problem, and then you need to repurpose that space, or you need to build up something else, I don't know, an air filter or something like that in the same space, but now you have different parts. So how much tolerance will you allow in your design for those kind of uncertain situations? So all of those kind of considerations are not taken into account in our current fire safety frameworks. It's kind of a, if it worked today, if we managed to demonstrate that this design is safe enough, whatever that means, whatever jurisdiction you find yourself making this argument, that's it. Over time, there will be changes in use. There will be changes in technology. There will be changes in maintenance. And we don't really account for that really well on Earth. So accounting for that in outer space probably will be much better because of the criticality and the all the money that is being put into it. Like the International Space Station is a very good example. That's why it has outlived its original design life. So it can be done. But I don't think it should be something that is done as we go and we kind of hope for the best. Because at some point, there needs to be some hard boundaries on what we actually design these things to withstand, whether it's from a reliability point of view in terms of systems, whether it's from a survival point of view in terms of occupants, and whether it's a survival of the structure itself. How much do we want?
I'm still thinking about the thing that if a fire happens, it happened, and there's consequences of that. On Earth, you would just, you know, put in some construction workers, put new devices and just fix the thing or rebuild the building if it collapsed, or, you know, clean the site and build a new, bigger building on that site. On Mars, if the window is, let's say, next 2 years that you can have a new resupply, you have to live with the consequences of that fire. And you lose that capability to just reset. Like, a fire stops being a singular event, and the second fire will perhaps be worse, and the third one, when you're already destroyed by two of them, is even worse. That's a cascade of consequences that we don't, I think, consider that much in, like, perhaps in underwater tunnels, I would consider that. That's the only space where I would maybe in some very high valuable process industry, you would think about the damage like that. But I think it's some sort of ultimate resiliency of the systems that perhaps could be a goal on their own. Like, it's not about just getting people to safety and shutting off a part of the colony. It's about where the colony can go with this new set of people and the resources and spaces now destroyed by the fire.
It's difficult to say anything like very strict on that. As in, I don't know the details.
It's a point of a brainstorm. We have no idea what. Like, none of ours is on Mars, and I would like to be one day, but...
My gut feeling for the moment is, and I think it's a bit speaks for itself maybe, is that you're going to try to avoid uncontrolled ignitions as much as possible.
Okay.
You're going to actually try to control ignitions as much as possible. Then somewhere in the back of my mind, by the way, you make a distinction between fires which are actually oxygen controlled and other ones which are just like runaway thermal effects. So if something is oxygen controlled, and especially if it's in a small space and everything which is critical is in a small space, then my feeling now is that you do have something like, okay, whoever is there, there should be almost nobody there because it's technical space, or just like a one person bot for sleeping, whatever, out, flooded. as in you completely cut it from all oxygen, if it is an oxygen-based fire. And so, now I'm making assumptions there, but my point being, you're going to avoid ignitions, you're going to extinguish as fast as possible, you're going to avoid fuels as much as possible as well. At some point, we talked about the fact that things burn, furniture, methane. But you have a choice to, at least in the early stages, right, as long as you're not talking about the city type thing, which starts to look like Earth, basically, and Earth problems. In the early stages, why should you have any combustible furniture? If you talk about methane production, yes, but why should it be in any way? It is still a problem, but why would it be within any of your structures? It's just the containment of the is outside of your main structure. It's a separate area. It's small. It's outside.
Ruben, let me jump into that because I had an interview with David Urban from NASA, who's managing space exploration and fire safety, and I asked him what later looked like quite a stupid question, because I asked him about the fire safety of unmanned exploration, you know, like the probes, the rovers and stuff. And he very quickly answered that there's no oxygen there. There's like no big risks to related to fire, because the fire is a risk where humans are present, because human presence requires oxygen. So perhaps like when you think about a complex or a colony, a base or something, perhaps the design should really strictly separate the human space, the oxidated space, from the space in which oxygen is absolutely not necessary or critical, and just put the stuff that we've discussed before, like production, things that burn. However, Jaime brought that you will have decorations, you know, architecture. That's going to be a difficult trait to have them completely non-flammable.
It's impossible. Yeah. It's impossible, guys.
Well, yeah, the reason why I was bringing it up, because it's a habitat. It's not like the International Space Station, right?
It's not a military mission. I guess the idea is that you can start a life there and live, not fight. I guess it will be very survival based, but it's supposed to be life.
And I guess you can pick apart some of the examples that I gave. You can, potentially say, well, methane, I don't know. You can just keep that in all the trash goes to this compartment, and that's something Wojciech said, and a compartment that is completely disconnected from any spaces that have
that's
oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's done. But again, for me, it also goes back to what are we prepared to accept? And I was going back to Ruben's original question about the boundary conditions. Mm-hmm. Say that everything goes bad. We designed it the best we could. We did all these calculations. We put all these systems, redundant systems, independent redundant systems. Very good compartmentation. Everything worked out as it should have, but unfortunately, it all went really bad. And there was a massive explosion or a fire that caused an explosion. Everything went bad, but people were able to evacuate. Let's say that at least we achieved the evacuation. So what would happen then? Because if those people evacuate to a space where they basically cannot be rescued or paid, then it's kind of pointless, right? Why did we do all of that? I mean, if the end result is going to be the same dramatic result, well, what's the point? Now, if they do have an escape strategy or a rescue strategy, that might change it. All right, well, the whole thing is lost, but those people are still safe and they can be rescued or they can go away. So I think that's also why the acceptance criteria is important, because if we define those boundary conditions, then we might be able to say, well, you know what? Let it all burn, let it all explode, as long as people make it safe to these particular set of compartments where they can stay for 1 month, 2 months while they're being rescued, then that's good enough. Or no one will be coming to rescue anyone. So this thing actually has to withstand and be able to enable living even after a fire. Then the whole thing changes, because I do think that even if it's cost prohibitive, then you will start to find out ways of identifying those places that have to survive no matter what. And that's why I was bringing it up, that in process safety, there are concepts such as facility layout.
Okay.
That we don't really use in fire safety. But basically, facility layout means that you can distribute the different units or functional modules that you have in your habitat in this case, so that if there is an explosion in one or a fire in another one, it won't affect whatever you don't want it to affect. And there's a way of designing this. It's not too fancy. It involves a little bit of optimization and consequence modeling, but you can implement some of that. It will cost more though. If you do it in a more prescriptive way or in a more cost-effective way, it will potentially be cheaper, but you will have all the risks grouped together. And when risks get together, they might be bigger than just their sum. So there are ways of doing that. But the question for me remains, how far do we want to go depending on what is acceptable? If we want to make it to ensure people are safe, to make it to that rescue module or standby module, that's one thing. If we actually have to ensure the whole thing continues to function as usual, that's a different
thing. For me, one thing that could be potentially crazy and really different from the Earth. Theoretically, let's say there's infinite amount of money on that, but in reality, it's not. There is not infinite amount of money that can be put into this type of exploration. Apollo program was already a significant part of the US budget, and they reached the moon, right? So humanity would have to stop war to go to space on an infinite budget. And there's too many people living from the war business to do that. So there is limited resources. And to provide these ultimate redundancies, like you can evacuate the whole 115 people into a second redundant space in which they could re-achieve the self-sustainability, you know, that to me means that you would have to double the cost of the base. Let's say it's a very like stupid assumption, but you would have to build maybe two bases so they have another one to evacuate to. But this means you have to send twice more kilograms to Mars, which means the cost of the operation is exponentially larger, which means that the time when we reach the Mars delays in time because we would have to accumulate those resources on Earth, you know, build bigger rockets, send a bigger armada to Mars, or perhaps spend more times with unmanned exploration, sending, you know, robots to build the base for us. You know, it delays it in time. And I think there would be a pressure to have this rather quickly. You know, the time is also a factor in here because we would like to have this type of permanent position before we destroy our own planet, which we seem to be quite good at. Now, I would also like wonder the people who go there. Like, we are applying a very earthy concept in here. You want to rescue them or you want to save them. The question is, are they fine with not being saved? You know, I would appreciate the first 115 people who go to Mars. It's not going to be a first 115 people you meet on a railway station. It would be 115 people who would be very willing to dedicate their life if it takes that. I wonder to what extent we could like balance in a way cost effectiveness of safety and perhaps the point at which we would put that cost effectiveness would be quite different than the one we would put in an earthly setting. And I guess it would change as the colony grows. Shemek gave us an example, 115, the smallest self-sustaining colony. But then he mentioned 1,000 people habited where you would have space tourists. And I guess space tourists would not be willing to risk their life that much for a nice trip. And then you would have colonies of 1 million people, a whole city or array of habitats where basically 100 people you can put in any of them and shelter them. It will be self-sustainable. So many different levels, many different layers. I want to be a spacefire engineer now.
I would say that all what we talk about is a kind of a acceptance of pioneering level,
yeah?
Because it all comes to that. Because as I believe in many, many centuries, we can say that we are not pioneers on Mars. But as for now, and so I believe in the next 200-300 years, this all will be looked at as a pioneering action. So pioneers accept bigger risks. Of course, it will, like Ruben said, it will differ from the number of people, and definitely it will change. And the level of individual risk will be diminished by the society. I think it's available. When you were talking about rescue areas, yes, they should be like that, but maybe not the double bays, mm-hmm. but the smaller ones. I call them in my simulation, I call them refugee areas when they are equipped like a fully, like a bunker. When you have all independent life support system, you have food, you have some
flammable architecture and decoration.
And the metal beds and then you have a kind of a door with a special sleeves or something like additional airlocks for the external services. I call the reps team that they come and help, because I believe there is no possibility that everybody is gathered in one place and they wait for some kind of a miracle. Need to be spread. The more such areas, the better you are prepared for any additional rescue actions. And I don't think that, of course, you can evacuate everybody to the Starship and fly back to the Earth. But you will have to, let's say, fight back. Mm-hmm. People don't want to die. People want to survive. They have a very strong need to survive.
At least the pioneers, because I think the society will grow, it will be more like a human-based society. Like, if you have 1 million people, it would be... I have no idea what the social structure would be there, but I don't think it would be pioneers anymore. I think it would be just people living their lives. That would be like in the Expanse video series, you know? Like, a whole society is identified there. But it's a different thing. I mean, I think focusing on colonies in this talk is the best option we have, because I think this brings also the biggest challenges in here. So,
First, maybe some highlights for me so far. So the aspect which was mentioned about the spatial planning, that was really nice.
Yep.
The pioneering level. Yeah. Very good. Well, very nice point.
It changes the environment, right?
It changes everything. So my feeling is in a way that we, at some point, we have been talking maybe in the back of our minds about different stages already, and that what we need to go, much forward in this fire safety is a more like a timeline,
mm-hmm.
where we say, okay, what is there? How many humans are there? Is it all just, is the construction being done by some robots or by a special team which has an external bot available because they're coming back to Earth in a couple of months after some work? Because this really will then define very much what Jaime was mentioning also about what your fire safety objectives will then probably be in those stages. Mm. I mean, the first people who arrive and who do the construction, assuming there's some humans available there in the early stages, yes, I mean, you cannot have much redundancy probably in those very, very early stages. Or at least it's almost impossible, except if you have multiple rockets, as you were saying,
mm-hmm.
where you have just, let's just immediately send multiple teams just because then they can help each other. Yeah, okay, but that's maybe challenging. So if you make this timeline and then probably up to the point where you have the 100 people colony, or maybe even beyond, but that if I understood correctly, would be many, many years. Divided in those stages, think about what do I want in each of those stages? What are my basically very broadly speaking design alternatives? And then we need to make sure, I know this is vague, but okay, still, something which is the ideal solution in stage one might not be the ideal solution in stage two. Mm-hmm. So how do you transition from one to the other? And maybe you don't go for your ideal solution just because you need that transition. So it's indeed this time aspect, I didn't think about before.
Would you think about it in a way that, let's say, there's a solution that would be perfect when the colony grows up? Say some sort of, I don't know, smoke suppression system. Oh, suppression system would be a great idea, because I guess your capability to create water will scale up with the size of the colony, because that will be related to. So if you wanted to use water-based suppression system, let's assume the bigger the colony, the more water you have. So,
well, that's a very, very fair point, right? So indeed, you talk about this million people city, big, large, open spaces, oxygen everywhere, comfortable living, everything.
Okay, versus tiny pods and closed space. But going following on the suppression. So you would have, let's say you design a system in which in a large city, you would reach a level of conventional suppression you would have on Earth. Like, it would be similar to what we have on Earth, but the same system, you would set pumps and devices to operate. If you have a smaller colony, the cost of water perhaps is prohibitive to use it in, suppressing. So you have a system that's perhaps perfect for stage two, in a way imperfect or backup solution for stage one, and you just live with the risk. Like, okay, stage one, we're not going to have the perfect water suppression systems, but that's the part of the risk of growing the colony and being a pioneer. And we understand that in stage two, this system will provide equitable safety to everyone around. And we're fine with that. And you don't send a tiny system for stage one, a bigger system for stage three, and a giant system for stage five, because the cost of kilogram to mass is prohibitive and pointless to do that all once. The time aspect is crazy.
But also the solution itself might be fundamentally different.
Yeah.
Right. If you think about this big garden space, almost like in a forest.
Eden.
Type,
yeah, right? Yeah.
Yes. There's an Eden Central Hall. It's amazing. But you cannot, I assume, like quickly do anything with the oxygen. It's too big. You can't do anything with the oxygen. There are many people there, evacuations. It seems very Earth-based, actually. I mean, barring from the gravity issue and so on. If you think about an early stage where everything, or at least many of the compartments are extremely small, basically, like, I'm thinking about the medieval monks almost, the monastery, all different pots and so on. Yeah, okay, but then there is an ignition in one pot. The single human who is there, if there is any, has to get out and it's flooded. The oxygen is removed, which would then might be physically possible. So the solutions might actually just be completely different.
In the episode about ISS, David Urban, he mentioned that the first reaction would be to shut down the ventilation systems, which shuts down the air movement. Okay, in Mars, you will have some buoyancy, so you cannot shut it down completely. Then it would be to seal the compartment and open, like ventilate the space. But for example, if they were going on moon, they didn't have air to do that too many times. So it was like really the last measure to vent out the oxygen because it's too precious.
But you say vent out, but when you this is not in the very first stages. But as soon as it gets a little bit bigger, wouldn't there be the kind of HVAC system where, I mean, you pump out air, but you don't just throw it away. You can pump it out.
Yeah.
That's
what would happen on ISS with the smaller fires. So
and also on Mir station, do you know this situation when there was a fire on station and it was in a few seconds it was totally smoke and the cleaning of this took a few days. So after they dealt with fire,
and David Urban was actually investigating that. I think it was in the podcast episode. So it was a very interesting thing. Because we have to wrap up, and I hate to do that because it's way more interesting than I thought it will be. Ruben, tapping into your experience as a structural engineer, I also wonder to what level, to what extent we would challenge the way how structures are built. Because, I mean, we're not going to drop a ton of brick and mortar on Mars to you know, build a cathedral in there, where I would assume we're going to either use some pressurized balloons, like we do that for tennis courts in Poland. You have a pressurized balloon in which you have a tennis court that rich people can use in winter time, and that works perfectly. And it's very interesting to design evacuation and stuff from that. You would have maybe 3D printed stuff. That's also perhaps interesting because you can send a regolith printing machine on the Mars 2 years before and arrive into like a semi-printed labyrinth that you can then fit out. Or perhaps tunneling and using natural caves or caverns would be a way. And in this case, the large spaces would form naturally. It's about whether you have air to, you know, pressurize it to the level of comfort. And in all of these cases, the structural fire safe, this is not, you know, steel beams protected to R30 in no way. I really wonder, like, to what extent we will have to challenge ourselves with the structural fire safe design of these buildings. And will it even be an important factor? Like, because if a fire is big enough to destroy the structure, perhaps it's already way beyond the acceptability limits wherever we said they are.
Yes, because you have decompression.
So what do you think as a structural engineer?
Well, on that last point, yeah, indeed, that's the impression I get, that especially in an early stage, you avoid ignition, you try to suppress as fast as possible and so on. And actually you're for many of the facilities, not necessarily all, you have to think about that, but the structural fire resistance will not be the crucial thing. While in a much later stage, certainly if you change everything again and you get to a more human base, if you heckle many, many stories and so on, lots of oxygen everywhere. On building on Mars, on that question, well, the only thing I could do when I was Google very quickly, what are the wind speeds on Mars and so on, because I have actually no idea.
They're massive.
So yeah, I can't immediately tell you what that means on strength-wise and so on.
Like, based on my limited knowledge coming from science fiction movies, they're massive. For sure. It's going to be a different set of challenges.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the fire stability, that for some areas where you want to contain a fire for whatever reason that you need to allow a big fire, okay, that's still there then. But for many other aspects, once you get in that stage, probably it's just, this is a loss. And then you have the big advantage that because of the outside atmosphere, that fire spread from one area to the other, I mean, external fire spread will not be a big issue, I guess. Mm-hmm.
In fact, can I have one question to
you? Yeah, sure.
Do you think that any of this methodology that I'm studying now, I'm studying different methodologies, but mostly I'm focusing on this, on what was done by you guys with IAPA. And do you think that this methodology somehow can be methodology, particularly not a particular solution, can be used as a beginning finding risk assessment in column? What do you think?
For me, the concepts, I mean, so we're talking about tolerability and then something which is a LARP as in cost and benefits evaluation. For me, this is so general and so broad that my answer is yes, this applies because it applies to anything everywhere, really. But then defining your tolerability, this is something which we have talked about in effect a lot today. And so it's not easy to do it, but the concept where you say first you have to say it's tolerable, and then once you say okay, these are my different alternatives for tolerable designs, what is cost effective, that basic concept, I don't see why that
do you think apply. It should evolve or some kind of change to stages of development
I'll jump in, Shumek. You have much better methodologies like J value, quality of life index. Maybe what it needs to develop is like success of mission index or best chance of growing into a million city index, and measured like in some form of LQI or J value that you would develop based on a defined goal. What's the end goal of your colony? And then measure like your success based on that index. That's a whole world to study and find out.
You can do Monte Carlo simulations and see how long
your colony will
your colony survives.
That's an interesting concept, actually. You could actually make a cellular automata with the compartments, assign probabilities for fires and consequences, and see as your resources diminish how far you can get. I am pretty sure you could simulate that with some bacteria on a petri dish. That could be very interesting. Maybe that's what we are. Final words. How does life safety on Mars look like for you?
So let's jump to your original question. What do you think about it?
Yeah. Okay. Look, so I understand that people who are going to be doing these pioneering kind of activities will have a very large risk acceptance, but there's also potentially going to be investors behind these, right? Because this, again, this is not a space exploration. This is a habitat. And correct me if I'm wrong, maybe I'm not understanding correctly, but this is not a kind of like, oh, well, it went up in flames. Well, we'll try better next time. So that's why, and apologies if I'm being stubborn with the acceptance criteria, but I think that that's a point to at least anchor what the solutions have to achieve. It's basically that goalpost that we need in terms of reliability, survival of people, survival of the structure. And as Simon was saying, if there are rescue or refuge pods that will give people a chance, it doesn't mean that they're going to make it, but it's going to give them a chance. Then you have a goalpost. Then, all right, everything can go up in flames potentially, but people have to make it there. Then you do have to ensure that compartmentation, that life support while people are evacuating is maintained to the very least, and the structural integrity of the structure of the structure through which they are escaping. So I think that we're well equipped in Earth with what we've developed, what we know, to use some tools and calculate what we need to provide those modules so that that is achieved. It doesn't mean that it's going to be easy or cheap, but at least you can aim to achieve that. Now, whether they make it after the fire, even if everything has gone up in flames or not, that's a different situation because, again, as Simon said, that's a risk that they're taking. But if the acceptance that we're happy with is that they're going to make it at least once after a catastrophic event, that's something we can design for. I want to believe that that's what we can design for. And I think that in the tunnels that you have been involved with, Wojciech, in the design, that's kind of the same idea. We allow for a lot of bad things to happen. And we know that, yeah, the system is not going to be ready for business 1 hour afterwards, but we know it's going to be good enough so that we clean up, fix a few things, and then get it back into work. And we won't have a Mont Blanc again in a tunnel because we've learned our lesson. The problem here is that we cannot have a Mont Blanc kind of event, learn our lesson, and try again, which is why I think we need to be very strict with those acceptance criteria, whatever they are. And from my experience, I kind of underline that point again, the importance of maintenance over time, especially in such a complicated space, potentially in spaces where you don't have oxygen, you need to go and maintain something in a space that doesn't have oxygen. So these kind of things are very complicated. They might all be working in day one, but what about day 1,000 or day 10,000? Safety for me, fire safety for me in this condition, in this outer space condition, means doing your best, which means setting a very strict criteria and sticking to it so that you give those people the best chance they can have. It doesn't mean that it's all going to work out because we know how uncertainties work, but that's kind of what I think would be the best we could do.
Ruben, what's your...
For me, but the thing which now at the end of stock is very strong in my mind is this timeline aspect. So, I mean, everything which had been said, it all made sense, but maybe in different parts of the development. And I didn't think about it before, but yeah, really seeing that you have the early stage, the later stages, and how to, when you transition your fire safety requirements and how you achieve it will probably change.
I'll take you for a few more sentences. And how does it look like all the stuff we talked today? And now you think about circular economy, sustainable built environment, very earthly problems. I mean, so many of these things apply the ultimate resiliency of your structure, the capability to maintain and repair at the lowest cost, reusability of systems. Like, I wonder, you know, when humans float to space for the first time, no one had expected this will lead to having microwaves and being able to heat up your lunch in 1 minute. When people were building large hadron colliders, we were not envisaging it will create a World Wide Web that will allow four gentlemen to meet and talk about risk on Mars someday. You know, so I wonder how brainstorming and working on these abstract concepts on fire safety in a completely different world could change our world.
Well, good point. As in, I have the feeling that we would definitely come up with different fire control, fire suppression systems.
Yeah.
And by doing that, because they might be so much more economical in a Martian environment, we will actually develop them. And having developed them, we might actually find out that it's actually very smart to use similar approaches on some places on Earth. Yes.
Fantastic. Thanks, guys. I was such a fun experience to do this brainstorm session. Let's wait for the critique of the audience. They are nasty. No, I'm kidding. I have the best audience ever. It's a bunch of nice people. And thank you so much for coming to the Fire Science Show. And Szymek, we have not even talked about the walking speeds on Mars. I'm sorry. That was fun. Guys, thank you.
Thank you both.
Cool. And that's it. Thank you for listening. As I said, it's an experimental episode. It's up to you to judge if it's a successful or a failed experiment. I wanted to take you into a middle of a discussion between fire professionals on a very abstract concept. I hope this helps, trigger these brain cells into thinking and coming with unexpected solutions and non-typical approaches to fire safety. That's what I wanted this conversation to be. And I must say, after this discussion, I was very rejuvenated by what was said and all the freedom we had to discuss a completely crazy thing, which is developing fire safety for a Mars habitat. I hope it worked the same for you. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please let me know how you look at episodes of this type. And perhaps you have an idea of what next brainstorm could be. Let me know. And I'll try to find some people to have this conversation with. And maybe we'll have more of those fireside chats on fire safety. Thank you for listening. And see you here back next Wednesday for another interview type episode that's coming your way. Cheers. This was the Fire Science Show. Thank you for listening and see you soon.